Welcome to Micro College. My name is Jacob Hunt. I am the director of Thoreau College. We are a micro college located in the beautiful Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin. If you're listening to this in late 2025, you should check out thoreaucollege.org. We are currently accepting applications for our spring 2026 metamorphosis gap semester, as well as the fall of 2026 metamorphosis gap semester, and also our 2026 Summer Driftless Field School starting on July 1st. Today on the podcast is my great pleasure and honor to welcome Jennifer DeCoste. Jennifer is a person I've been wanting to talk to on the podcast for a long time. I've admired her work and her energy from afar. And this summer, I had a great pleasure to meet with her in person in Denmark at the International Folkemøde for Educators, folk high school, folk school gathering with people from all over the world. So, yeah, Jennifer is speaking to us from Antigonish in Nova Scotia, Atlantic Canada, a beautiful area I've had a chance to visit before. Antigonish is a really special town, source of a number of initiatives that we'll hear about. But Jennifer is dedicated to work that builds strong and connected communities. She is the founder of a nonprofit network of barter-based folk schools called Life School House that began in Nova Scotia. This platform for grassroots skill sharing creates stronger, more interconnected neighborhoods and reduces the impact of social isolation by offering nourishing spaces where neighbors can learn, connect, and thrive. This project has been scaled globally, and Jennifer is the first person in Atlantic Canada to receive the prestigious Ashoka Fellowship for her work. Jennifer and her partner are also growing a new social enterprise in Nova Scotia called Firelogh, a space in the forest for community care and continuous learning. As a social enterprise, Firelogh is a forested retreat space with a sustainable model to support charitable work, offering bursaries and scholarships for deep rest and care for teams from the nonprofit and charitable sector in Nova Scotia. Jennifer has two children and sources great joy from introducing them to the true prosperity in Atlantic Canada, a history of cooperative action, the shared wisdom of multiple generations, and the kindness of strangers. Thank you for joining us, Jennifer.
Thanks for hosting tonight, Jacob.
So, as I mentioned before we came on, on the podcast, I always like to ask people a little bit about their biographies and specifically what they were up to around the time the students that we work with here at Thoreau College, who are mostly in their 18, 19, and early 20s. So, wonder if you could think back to where you were in that age range. What were you doing? What were you thinking about? Who were the big influences on your life? And how has that shaped where you've gone since?
So when I was 18 and I had completed my grade 12 education, I don't know that I had a lot of choice in terms of my path. I would have been the third generation of women in my family to go to post-secondary education at a local university called St. Francis Xavier. My grandmother attended that school as a college associated with that university before women were allowed to attend the university. So there was a path that I was predicted to follow, which at 18, I put my head down and followed the path. So I went for 4 years and did an undergrad education at this school, which is a wonderful school. But I will say I spent most of my time there focusing on leaving. Like I spent an awful lot of time thinking about what was next, worked very hard to try and convince them to let me do my 4-year degree in 3, and ended up moving midway through my education in that 3rd year. Because I had already secured full-time employment on the other side of the country and just transferred credits back. I was so eager to start. I didn't even know what starting looked like, but I did feel like staying in that one place, learning in a particular way, was not the ideal match for me, and I was eager to get out into the world. So that was my 18 to 21.
So, were you mentioned a strong family tradition of doing this, and was there, what did your family think about that path? Or did you get a lot of pushback? A lot of it, was that hard?
I think they're used to me. I'm a conundrum to my parents. I've been a source of great confusion, I think, for a really long time because it, like they were both my mother was a teacher, my father worked for government. They lived that very boomer generation stereotype themselves, without asking a lot of questions, without they certainly did not lead with a lot of curiosity in their early years. They were following a path. So to come across, I think, a child who acknowledged the path and then like sidestepped the path and found other ways around it. It caused a lot of confusion. I wouldn't say I ever lost support, but definitely lots of are you sure? And that was okay with me.
So as I mentioned, I think the place there where you started out and where you've returned to, is it's a particular place. I think it's a place that I've had the chance to visit because actually my own sister went to St. Francis Xavier, and played hockey there, women's hockey, and it's a place with a strong character, I would say. So this is rural northern Nova Scotia, not too far from Cape Breton Island. Could you just give us a little picture of the place there? Because that is important for folk schools and some of the things that we're talking about.
It is, yeah. And I don't think as a child I knew how significant that was. But I think a lot of people who come to that university are meeting for the first time a real sense of interconnectedness. The campus community is very distinct from the town that kind of wraps around it. It's insular. It's, old ivy-covered buildings that are all centrally located. Both housing and classes take place in quite a small footprint within quite a small town. I think the population of the town doubles when school starts. So the university is a very vibrant part of the town, and also like it keeps to itself a little bit. You can have a very distinct of the town experience when you're at Saint-Évec. So a lot of people come to the university so that they know that they're in classes that are quite small. They know that they're professors are going to know their names. They know that the alumni network is incredibly strong. I've tapped into it all over the world. It is kind of part of the offering is a sense of community. But I think because I had grown up in a family that was already so interwoven with the university, I already had a touch point with that and didn't need more of it. My grandmother's kitchen table was a microcosm of that kind of community, that debate, that people coming in and coming out all of the time. Tea always on the stove. You never really knew who was going to be there when you walked in the door. So having grown up that way, I guess maybe I didn't need it as much as perhaps others who were seeking that out. And that probably influenced my connection with this town. But the other thing that Saint-Évec is well known for is that it's the home of the Cody Institute. And so in context of folk education internationally, about 130 years ago, and remaining true, our region of Canada is very much a resource-dependent region. It's never been affluent. It's kind of like the poor cousin, I would say. And the resources that we're quite dependent on, of course, are fishing and mining. So coal mining in particular, a very dirty kind of way to make a living. And 100 some odd years ago, 130, 150 in that range, coal mining was non-optional for a lot of families in this region. They would leave family farms as, mortgages were called in. It was extremely difficult to maintain a family farm, especially when you had a lot of children. It's a very very Catholic region of the world, very Irish, very Scottish. And so big families unable to maintain farms, lots of children leaving home would have ended up in these coal mines. The coal mining towns would have been built by the owners of those mines. They owned your house, they owned the school, they owned the church, they owned the shop where you bought all of your supplies. And very quickly, multi-generational poverty set in, and it meant that a lot of people were restricted from ever being able to kind of break free of that yoke. And yet, well over 100 years ago, 120 some odd years ago, there was a rogue priest by the name of Moses Cody, and Jimmy Tompkins was a large contributing member of the clergy as well. They had this idea that kitchen table learning was going to be the thing that changed the entire region. Like, if we could come together and learn together, remember even beyond learning, like remember how to plant potatoes, for instance. If we could learn how to plant a potato and harvest a potato, that those potatoes that you could raise for your own family would mean that you were not beholden to the store to go buy the potato. So that might save you a penny this year, it might save you 2 pennies next year. One of the ideas that these two individuals were able to bring back to our region by way of going out into the world and tapping into some of the social movements that were happening in Denmark at the time was the idea of cooperative banking. So if you saved a penny with your potatoes and I saved a penny with my potatoes, very quickly, two pennies coming together would have greater impact. And so this region was able to pull itself out of that cyclical poverty, not quickly, not easily, but together. And it came through the fundamentals, like learning how to engage politically by learning at a kitchen table, learning how to plant, successful harvesting techniques at a kitchen table. A lot of those, that foundational kitchen table learning became what's now known as the International Cody Institute, which remains a significant institution on the campus of Saint-Évêque's University. So it really did. The cooperative banking movement in North America actually started at this in this tiny little place on Cape Breton Island in Inverness County, and there's many people who would know that story and could tell it better than I can. But it really was a big part of the story of this place and this town, and its kind of global contribution from a teeny tiny place.
Yeah, it's an inspiring story. And yeah, the Cody Institute is how I ever first heard about Antigonish and St. Francis Xavier as well. And how many places around the world are there that have this resource dependent kind of economy and coal mines or or some of the resource that are dependent? They're really in a hard place in the kind of global capitalist kind of system. So it is very inspiring to have a story like, what can you do about that? And the other thing that's striking about that is, it connects with your work is the locus of it in the home around the kitchen table, right? I think it just occurs to me that something that other people might know about that region, Cape Breton, is like music and also the home as a locus for music, kitchen parties and things like that, or people may have heard of. But I think it's a great connection to your project with Life Schoolhouse. So maybe, yeah, can you just tell us about the genesis of that project and really it's another movement that's originated that you've originated and it's gone out into the world. So very inspiring.
Well, Life Schoolhouse was never supposed to be a movement. If it had been planned that way, I probably would have done a lot of things differently, to be honest. And maybe the same thing applies to all like grassroots social organizing. But Life Schoolhouse, like you said, is a network of interconnected barter-based folk schools. The idea of using this network of folk who are interested in skills sharing as a means to connect the humans to reduce that negative impact of social isolation and loneliness, right? It really came from a very self-serving place. Like I was raising two kids. I was in a city. I was relatively new to that particular area of the city. Didn't really know my neighbors. Like I knew my neighbors, but I didn't know, which is like such a common problem, I think, in a city. And the handful of neighbors that I did know, we'd invited a conversation that actually stemmed from a family conversation that I'd had when we moved into that home. We have two boys, and my husband and I moved into this home when we bought this property. And in Canada in particular, Nova Scotia in particular, that we live in unceded territory. This was never ceded to the Canadian government. And in particular, in Atlantic Canada, Nova Scotia, we're governed by what are called the Treaties of Peace and Friendship. So we here in as settlers in unceded territory, Mi'kma'ki, What does it actually mean for a settler family to buy a house, to own land in even in a city where, it's super common? What does that actually mean? Like, it wasn't not part of my education growing up. We didn't talk about these things. We were not talking about truth and reconciliation work in Canada, at the time that I was kind of coming of age and grounding my morals and principles. So it really kind of had to become an active conversation that we were having as a family. Like, whoa, like we owe paperwork to the lawyers and the bank and the realtor and like everybody, but there's nobody that's talking about our responsibility to the land. So basically, what we landed on is we don't know necessarily what to do about this, but we'll probably be better able to find the answer if we ask lots of people. So we had an open house and we threw it out and said, what could we do? What could we use this house for? Like, in what ways could we as a neighborhood come together? What would you like to see happening more of or differently in our community? And we had however many people, might have been 12. 15 people maybe showed up for that conversation. And I'm sure I still have the poster somewhere. And we just like put a we just put a bunch of post-it notes on the wall. And we saw like ideas kind of bubbling up for like, ooh, like what if we pooled some childcare? And like, what if we had a drop location for farm boxes to come into the city? And what if we did all these kinds of things to make shared use of the property, so that we're treading as lightly as individuals as we can, and that we are with intention towards peace and friendship, sharing this space communally. Because we still need a safe place to raise our two kids. Like, this is a home. We made a conscious decision to make this house into a home. So what could that look like? So we had like all kinds of these ideas. And the one that kept circling around was like, I don't even know if we use the word skill sharing, but like classes. Like, what if so and so could just come and teach whittling and carving and baking and sewing, and like we just have friends who can do stuff. What if we started sharing our skills a little bit? So that one kind of bounced out a number of times, and so we grabbed it and we said, okay, well, let's see. Let's, like I said, this was not supposed to be a movement, it was just like a way of living in this house. The first class we landed on was like, why don't we just throw some posters up around coffee shops, telephone poles, whatever? Tell people that at this house, at this time, we're going to be teaching Fermentation 101. That's what our first class was. And it was because we had free stuff. Like, we were brewing kombucha at our house anyway. My kids thought that was pop. So it's not hard to skim off some Scobies and share the knowledge. That is free. So we told people to show up. Also, Scott was really at that time into sauerkraut and cabbage and carrot and whatnot, not expensive. So we said, we're going to kind of introduce Fermentation 101. And we put up these posters that said, bring a mason jar. And I think three people came to the first class and they were all very brave, like knocking on the door, being like, I saw, like, is this a place for a class? Because it's like, it's a little weird going to someone's house for a thing. They thought they were going to a place for a thing, but they came to a house. So that, and then we did another one the next week. I can't remember what the next one was, but like two people came. And then we did another one the next week and like seven people came. And then ba 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 ba. So it was wild. We did over 50 classes our first year in our living room.
I remember I
And we
heard that this summer, and that
were
seems wild to me. That seems having hosted classes, folk school classes, teaching things out of my house. That's an incredible commitment.
It was so cool though. Like, people would, cause I don't have a lot of practical skills. I am a doer of lots of things and a master of very, very few, but I have really smart friends, and that is like a lifestyle choice. So, yeah, we just kept getting calls from friends saying that looked like fun. I could do this. Great. What are you doing next Thursday? So while the momentum was still there, we just kind of went with it, and it went very well and very quickly. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months in, not long of doing this and having a great time, somebody knocked on the door and said, could I do this too? And that, I think, like in terms of movement making, like that guy dancing on the side of the hill, right? It's the first follower that makes it a thing. And so somebody said, could I just, like, I drive 2 hours to get to your stuff. Could I just do the same thing at my house? I was like, have at her. What do you need to get started? And not much, but I'll share what I have, what I've learned. You know, we've made some, I don't know, social media posts or et cetera. So we put a Google Drive together and said, you know, let me know how it goes. And then very quickly we had probably 10 or 12 going in the province of folks who were also willing to like just try the thing. So that was a really interesting, it was not a plan. Not planned, but fun.
Well, there's so many things I love about this story. The first one is starting with the fermentation, because that is the first class that we did with the Driftless Folk School here was a sourdough class. And there's something very potent about that metaphor of, a culture, right? You've got a culture
I
of
love it.
microorganisms that then you're passing on. Everyone leaves the class, goes away with it. And that, you can see, that certainly was what happened metaphorically and literally in your case. So
Yeah, I love that. I don't know that I've really thought that deeply about it, but it is very true that there are a whole bunch of people who now have like that connection to a living organism that we shared right from day one. So that's pretty cool.
The other thing that the next thing is, the gesture, and you're rooting in the history and in the land history, and the native peoples in the region is interesting. That gesture to open a space, say, what should we do here with this house? I think a lot of people, borrow money from the bank and buy a house, but very few people open up that sort of space. And I think I wonder, just behind that, what allowed you to do that, or what gave you the idea that that was that you should do that?
There is something in this region that begets cooperative action.
Evidently.
Yeah, like I think it's in the soil. So and also like with a nod to my ancestry, I think like the epigenetics of that made it possible for me in a way that maybe it wouldn't have been like the first instinct of people, but it's like it was it's in my blood and in the soil, so it's kind of like you're of course you did that thing. My grandfather actually started the first radio station in Atlantic Canada, and he called it the University of the Air. Because the intention at the time was to use a super cool, brand new, fancy schmancy technology of radio to get knowledge out to the people. And to make it entertaining, to make it a part of like being in their living room. He had like this character that he played almost when radio was a whole other way of connecting, right? So like I think it runs in the blood, it runs in the soil. And I mean, as does racism run pretty deep. White supremacy is like a part of a lot of the systems that we operate in. So I will absolutely name that there's also like white guilt around ownership and like and not knowing. There's a lot of things that I don't know about my own privilege of being able to access resources to do this kind of thing. And then if, since I don't know what I don't know, like the guilt around like how do I learn more about this has come up a number of times, and it's always for me come back to like ask the people, ask my neighbors, ask as like invited in, invite in the learning, invite in the unknowing, like it I don't know, maybe it's a part of mothering too, like how do I raise humans
That's a big
now,
question. Yeah.
right? That's a
Yeah.
big, like, I don't feel prepared. I did not feel prepared to do that from the moment they're like, here's the baby, see you later. I'm like, it's been a constant kind of figuring it out as you go thing. So maybe it's also that, like knowing that I know how to do this, I should use that as a resource to figure out all these other questions that I have about how to live respectfully and how to live in right relationship with the land and with the people that I care about. And yeah, it's ongoing questions, I think.
The concept of Skillshare, you mentioned feeling that, you didn't know how to do very much. You were you didn't feel like you hadn't mastered anything. But you were able to demonstrate that there was a lot of skills there in your immediate community, right? And that people were excited to share. And there's the old story, a parable, folk story about stone soup, right? We are impoverished here. We don't have anything. You create a context. You create an empty pot and invite people to put things into it, and suddenly you have a feast, right? And I think that's what
Totally.
another kind of resonance I hear with your story. And then all of a sudden you have abundance, right? Of knowledge and of SCOBYs and other things too. So.
You know what was interesting is that, like, if even we saw it right away within the first couple of months, the abundance was not even necessarily the skills being shared or the production of the things that we now know how to do, like the sourdough bread and the salsa canning and the, trying to think of non-food related things, but I'm hungry because it's supper time. The people were not coming. The skill was an extra. The skill was a bonus. They were coming because they were lonely. And we didn't name. Like I said, the post-it note party that we had was just like what would be fun. It wasn't like what is the change we want to see in the world.
Right.
But we landed on it fairly quickly. We identified the impact because in conversations and just like generally observing, like we very quickly got to a point where we couldn't post tickets for the events more than a week in advance. Because we used to post like here are the things that are happening this month, and the same people would take every ticket, which made it wonderful because you would really get to know these people quite well. But they would end up basically living in my living room, and it was really hard for new people to be found to show themselves to us, then to surface their talents. So it was really like a tightrope of like we want to get into deeper relationship, which does involve spending more time together, but we also want to welcome in the new and balancing that was tricky in the first year, and it wasn't really about the skills. They loved the skills. That was the reason. Your hands are busy, but it's like you could sit next to the same person on the bus for years and not know them at all. Or see them walking on the sidewalks and not really know them until and then know them so you differently when they're in a hosted environment. And that's a different differentiating factor too. So the life school host really depends quite heavily on a hosted environment. So it's not
Right.
just the class, right? There's always two people involved. There's the teacher and there's the host, and they're not the same. They don't play the same role. The host is there to ensure that the connection is being met, where so that the facilitator can just focus on sharing the skill. The host is there to be like welcoming, putting a cup of tea in your hands, come in, I'm glad you're here. Do you know so and so? And then watching as you go, like, is there a look of confusion? Maybe you can ask the question if it looks like they won't, or inviting in, like, if there's someone that may be sitting in a corner or hasn't spoken recently, or like their role is really to make sure that if what we've identified that is important is that people feel connected, then we had to shift the model a little bit to emphasize that role and to support the role of the hosts more so than we needed to support the facilitators. The teachers, they were great. They were going to come in and bring a skill. It was like the skill development piece really centered around the role of the host.
Yeah, so that there's a couple of really just brilliant and I think also subtle things about the model that you've developed that I'd wanted to bring out, and that was certainly one of them, right? So you started, you were the host and you were inviting in the people with the skills, is that right?
Because I have few skills,
That
but I can make tea.
the skill is
So
we're
yeah,
learning, right?
that's how it started.
So
Yeah, but it
yeah,
did seem
so.
to work, so it became modeled. Yeah.
Yeah, that clearly is a visionary part of this that allowed it to flow, because it is certainly thinking about our the folk school we've created here, you start with talking about the skills, like the people teaching them. But that if you, I think there's awareness that the purpose of these, the folk school world in general is about building community. It's about building relationship. And if that's your goal, if that's the emphasis, then you really need to center that, right? You need
Got to
to
shift your
think about like
resources.
what makes that work? What is, what does it need to have someone do that? And how is it different from just teaching about baking bread or carving spoons or something like that?
Totally. Yeah. It changes how you spend, you use your resources. It changes the feeling, the experience. If it, if it is well hosted, it does change the experience for the attendees. Then if you're going to, say, a public library or a paint night, where you show up at a bar with a friend and you paint a thing and you probably only talk to the person that you brought with you and then you leave, you've had a unique experience, but it has not been one of developing a sense of community. That hosting thing became really clear to us really early on that it was a key role. And those that would be successful replicating the model would be people for whom that's not, that's just who they are. Like, it's not something they have to put on. So pairing a person for whom that is just like who they are as a person with a whole bunch of people with great skills and talents, that seems to be the magic, that allows for different pop-up folk schools to be successful in this network.
Yeah. So you, this has become a movement, and right away you had someone coming asking if you could do it. So there's got to be, I'd imagine there are people who are more talented at this, who are called to it, whose sense of being a host is something that they feel comfortable and able to do. But you also are providing support and a template for that. Like, what kind of guidance or how do you support other people who want to do something like this in their own community or in their own home?
Okay, so 2018 was this 2018 into 2019 was that wild first year of like, wee, let's just do all the things. And then 2019, it showed itself as like something that had legs that other people wanted to do. And then I found like I was spending a lot of my time supporting others getting started with something. So that's when I went out and said, huh, this is kind of becoming a job, which is a joyful job, but I was already working full time, and then I was also still hosting like while with a wild schedule, and then all of these other people were like, "Help me, help me, help me." So, what we did was we leaned in heavily to the networked approach, the collaborative approach, even to the design of like the resources. It was not something that I was going to say I had all figured out. Here's the plug and play toolkit for this. It was like we started having gatherings, hosts gatherings, where people who were curious or people who were already engaged would come together, and we started to think together about like, what do we want to learn more about? What are we learning just through observation? And so that first year was kind of writing some stuff down, and then pandemic, 2020. So, I mean, that just like just as we were starting to get, we had people like spreading out across Canada, hosts in New Brunswick, hosts in Ontario, it which just psh, and it was a particularly challenging time where we were living because we went into this thing they called the Atlantic bubble, and basically it was like no one was allowed in or out. Everybody had a different approach. That was the one we were living with. Strange times, but it did mean that we could continue to gather. They basically were hanging on the edge of North America, right? We were kind of able to shut down the border. And whether or not that was the right decision is a whole other conversation, but it so we in 2020 were having a very different lived experience than people in the rest of the world. And but what we were observing was that the thing that we like, this is an organization that should have faltered, closed its doors during a pandemic, when what we were advocating for was in-person gatherings for the health of community, like the exact opposite of the pandemic conversations. But at the same time, like it was when our organization started to blow up, because everybody was saying, "You've got something here that I did not even realize we needed until you." We took it away, and then it became like a health hazard to not have connection with each other, to not have anyone checking in on people in community. Like, we had a lot of people in our network who were older, particularly women, who I knew they were okay because we had spent 2 years building a sense of community. There were lots of people that, like, would check in on Barb and Noreen and like who that they might not have had that those people checking in on them if we hadn't been doing this work for 2 years. And it kind of surfaced like this is really important work at a time when we were being told not to do the work. So we used our time to, and we wrote it down. We wrote a book. We're like, here's we don't know that we know this yet, but what we've got is some ideas. We can share some stories. We wrote a storybook. It was not an instructional manual. It is not everything. It is what we were able to do during the pandemic was say, you know what, you're right. We do need more of this. Here are some of the stories of the things that we've been doing that are helpful. So that's available on the website now. Then we
Paper
started
community.
doing, Tea for Community is the name of the book. And that was one of the things that we found, like the great equalizer, right? Like put something in someone's hands so they know what to do with their awkward hands. Tea was a great equalizer. And those were just some of the lessons that we learned. So people can grab that. And
Just
then
a, I
we
think
had.
in the US, I think it's being distributed through the Folk School
It is.
Alliance, I believe. So
Yeah,
yeah,
that's true.
we'll
For
share those
free,
links
they'll send you
in
a
our
tangible
chat.
physical copy.
Yeah.
The ebooks online anywhere that people may be listening to this in Singapore, you never know your great reach, right? So yes, yeah, available online, but it is through the Folk School Alliance. The physical book can be mailed out anywhere in the United States.
Wonderful.
So
Yeah, I mean that social isolation, right, as a, you know, as a condition in our times, I think that yeah, it became obviously acute. You know, it's been acute for a long time, but people had a name for it and started talking about it, I think, in that pandemic period for sure.
But also at the same time, what I was observing was like the need for that sense of connection drew even more people to people like me. So people who were ho like hosting or still organizing at a time when everyone was like stressed to the max and really only like a lot of people went inside to the family. We were continuing to go outside. In terms of the resources and supports, I wouldn't say we were hosting like grand, large-scale gatherings or anything, but like we ran a food pantry out of our front porch for probably a year and a half. We would take in donations and put food out into the community, like 8 or 9 times a day. Like it was just a really steady flow of constantly kind of refilling this pantry. We had classes where small groups of people could gather in our backyard because we had a backyard. And when we couldn't meet there, we'd meet in parks. We would meet in, you know, we started getting creative about third space during the pandemic. Like, how do we reclaim spaces? Like the way that we used our home, where it exists in our communities. What else out there could become third spaces? Like, they're not our office environments, they're not our homes, but like, what else is there where we could start to gather? So that became an interesting part of the experiment that led to like new hosts, because some people were like, I cannot get my head wrapped around hosting in my living room total strangers. That's a big reach for a lot of people. And so what we landed on was that you don't have to. Like any place that people can gather under a tree or can gather, you know, with a bit of shelter enough that you can sit there for 45 minutes to an hour and share some thoughts and share some ideas, like that can be a folk school, a place where folk are gathering to educate and to connect and to share and to think together. And so that was the gift, I'd say, of the pandemic. That in time, we had some time to write some stuff down. And yeah, but the call to move and scale the work was pretty heavy at that moment, because even with the Ashoka Fellowship that you'd mentioned earlier, Ashoka is an organization that really encourages the scaling of social movements, and they identify scale very much with more of a vertical model, so like expanding up and bigger organizations. So like we took on some staff and we were, you know, doing projects down in the States and in Mexico, and like it was just. And my kids weren't in school for like 2 years. They were just like at my kitchen table staring at me while I was trying to get this organization up and running. It was very complicated. And I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I burnt out. And I was noticing people around me who were doing this kind of community care work were also really, really struggling. And So that was the 2021 realization, was like, oh no, we've built this beautiful model and we're telling people that you should just do this. But we hadn't equipped it with some of the skills around like boundaries. Like, don't be a gen. 50 in a year. That's it. That was, I mean, that was fun for me. I'm not suggesting that that would be fun for you. And also, it was in a different world, in a different time. It feels like 2018 to 2025, like different planets. So, we have added over time some like a mental health toolkit, these resources that can go along with event organizing and community development that now exist in a shared Google Drive, and people who join into the network and want to try experimenting with skill sharing, barter-based kind of classes. We encourage them to tap into like think about all of the things and how you can create some balance for yourself and when to say yes and when to say no. And so it's that's been a new layer that got added only through discovery of need, personal experience with like, oops, did that wrong, pivot.
I think the causes, this is action research. This is you're finding out by doing it. So I think that leads us a bit to what you're doing right now with Firelock and the next organization. But before that, I wanted to talk the other like really radical, interesting, unique thing about this is it's barter based, right? So talk about the financial model or like why or or like the resource model that is behind that. Why barter and how does that actually work?
Yeah, barter. Barter is an
Mm-hmm.
interesting one because I mean, again, our reason for doing this was to gather our neighbors in a kind of a barrier-free, like we've got the space in this house, let's use it. And barter was a way to reduce any barriers folks would have to participating in programming. So instead of having a tangible like $15 to participate or $50 for a class, it was within your means, bring something to gift to the facilitator. Not the host either. The gifts went to the facilitator who organized the class and were sharing their skill, because a lot of the skill development, like to be good, I've taken a sourdough baking class 12 times. The only thing that I've learned is that I now have lots of friends who can make bread for me.
Yeah.
So like it is something that takes like to be able to get to a point where you know something well enough to share it with somebody else, that needs to be honored. And like a monetary exchange has, it serves lots of purposes. One of the things that it does not do well is to connect the humans, right? But if when I'm thinking I want to come to this class to bring to source, to think through what would this person consider to be valuable, like what have I grown in my garden, what have I put some time into canning, what have I sown or carved or sourced out in community and fixed, you know, what are the things that I can put my hands on that demonstrate my humanity sees their humanity. And now we're in a reciprocal, like equal exchange. That was the goal of bartering. And to feel like so many of our facilitators that first year, like going reading back through some of the feedback forms that we had collected, they're just like, this is better than Christmas. 'Cause you get like such heartfelt like exchanges were happening in community. It was really quite lovely. It continues always to be really lovely. But again, one of those things not incredibly well thought through at the time, but then became a really big part of what we were doing, like what we learned about the human exchange and the connection. Like I can look around this room and probably find 30 things that were either made or given to me. Those are the things that I keep. There's the soul of the person is in the things. So a lot of people have made cookies for my kids over the years, right? Or like whatever it happens to be. So like that's very different than $10 to come to a class. It's led to lots of conversations though in community around fairness. And like I don't know. Because of capitalism, we don't have conversations about fairness. This is what I decide this is worth, and that is what it is. And yeah, so it was interesting to be witness to a lot of conversations or even just watching people process like fair. Because sometimes if you have nothing, like no one has nothing to give. There's always, you know, a poem that you can write, or a recipe you can share that you loved, or, you know, and if that's a big thing for you to give, that has value. And people do remember it that way in this type of a community. So it's been an honor to watch that thought process, because there's not a lot of spaces in the world where you actually have to think that through right now. So barter.
Barter,
Part of
yeah,
the
certainly
experiment.
there's a continuum of gift, barter, like payment, right? Those relationships are, I think, are not well articulated in much of our culture. You know, they're, you know.
It also is really challenging to sustain an organization on barter. So, like in those early days, if we wanted to do something as an organization, it costs us $5 to run this organization for well over a year, because it takes $5 to open a bank account. We had to have a bank account in order to qualify for a nonprofit status. So we put $5 in the bank account, and then we did nothing, no fundraising, no nothing, like for at least a year and a half. There was never any money exchanged. And if we wanted to do a class on canning, we put out a note to the Facebook group. I remember I woke up one morning, there's 200 mason jars in our driveway. Like years we were still given. It must have been, maybe there was 400. I don't remember. Scott was like, what are we going to do with all these mason jars? Because it, so we did the class, and then we did 12 more classes, and then we gave our gifts away in mason jars. Like it was just ridiculous. But in the community, there were basements full of dusty old mason jars. So that was something that the community had to give, and we built classes around the assets that were available. And then we reached a point where if you want to do things like, you know, quit your job, and do this as a job, where I was supporting the expansion, the scaling of this as a social movement, like the power company does not accept pickles on exchange, right? Like
A poem,
they
right? Yeah, right.
And there were just definitely periods of time where, you know, the certain classes that you wanted to be able to offer, you wanted to be able to say, come, I will buy the leather that we require, or I will, you know, remove the barrier, but it needs to be a financial barrier that's removed. So that led to like a conversation about re-engaging differently with philanthropy. That's a whole other podcast on rethinking how we engage with philanthropy, but like that's complicated for lots of reasons. But for some people, even within the barter system, money is the thing they had to give. They didn't have a lot of time, or they didn't identify as particularly talented, but they're like, I want this to happen. I see what you're doing. This is good. In particular, we had one philanthropic funder who was like, you know what? I'm going to give you 3 years of a runway of funding. I need you to keep at this.
Wow.
And that's huge. That's huge. Like to be seen in that way and to name that as something that is important to our community. Like we never had any government funding. We never had any, you know, stipends or grants or for years and years. But barter has its limitations because we still live in this existing system, and barter will not be the next model. Like it is not a futures thinking, you know, what's on the horizon. It was just kind of like a thing we could practice, so that if financial systems fall around us, we'd be ready for whatever rises up. Like it's easier if you've been experimenting to take a leap to whatever's coming. But we did still need money to do things, so it became it shifted the model a little bit when we engaged. But our preference, our distinct preference, was to do it with our community, which is where philanthropy kind of came into play differently than like grant writing and begging government for support.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, everyone can hear that, and Jennifer and people who are creating and running and holding these cultural forums are doing really real work, right? It's great to hear that there's some financial resources to support what you're doing, and that's coming from the financial sector. I think one of the things that I hear in your story that leads into to the next thing is that there's also need for emotional, psychological, and kind of respite kind of help for a person who's spending and just putting so much of themselves into this work of building community and building and supporting these new models to develop. And so I think that leads into Firelock. I wonder if you could now share that story and what's that about?
I have a series of like not making solid plans and then having things happen anyway. Because this also was definitely not a plan, but I had named for you a moment ago like the recognition of like, wow, maybe this model itself is actually inviting people to burn themselves out in support of others. Like, I hadn't thought of that because it was so wrapped up in the joy of it. And then you had the pandemic and you had two kids in the mix. My partner at the time was engaged in home building, and so he was considered essential resource. So he just like went out to work like everything's the same as ever. 5:30 in the morning, he'd disappear, and it was just like very intense to be a f like in that fear culture and like anyway, pandemic, hard times. And the constant activity and the expansion of programming and da da da. So at the end of that, like 2020 into 2021, I was really struggling, and we certainly had a lockdown that first year, and then they did it again that second winter. They pulled our kids out of school, and so all, like the systems of support for me as a working parent weren't there, and yet I was still being a support for others in my community. Yeah, definitely I didn't name this as burnout at the moment. I just had this like panic at the end of 2021, heading into 2022. I was like, oh my God, what if we do this forever? Like, if this is a cycle that will now repeat forever, like, so it was like fight or flight kicked in. And we moved. We packed up our house, moved two kids, ran away. Like, we did not move to a place, we left a place. And looking back on it now, I'm like, my gosh, it must have been so bad for me to think that leaving that community that we had built that was so tightly interwoven and such a big part of our life, like how bad must it have been for me to think that the only option for me was to run away from it? Like that the dark side of the moon. And so we ended up running, landed in this place that was safe for me, right? It was like a come home to family and figure it out situation. Did not intend to stay here, but found ourselves kind of curious about what it would be like if we were to come back home, like if we were really to be here in this place, and found like only when we were ready, this land that we're on right now, it was almost as if it waited for us. Like there was so that at the time, properties in particular were turning over very, very quickly. People were buying like sight unseen. It was a very bizarre real estate market, and we were 4 months just to catch our breath and to get kids' education sorted out and whatnot after a transition. And 4 months later, it was still listed, and I was like, "There's must be something wrong with this." And we came here, and it's just stunning. So there's 60 acres of land that we have a small house on, and there's but the trails were cut for 60 acres, and I got a dog, and I walked and didn't talk to anybody for like 6 months, and at the end of it, I realized like this is really good medicine. This is something in alignment with life's philosophies. How do we share this forward? How do we make this possible for other people to catch a rest too, for whom the running away was not an option? We need to do this. Like it shouldn't a shouldn't get so bad that you feel like you have to, but also like what are the mini breaks that we can take so that you don't reach that point of absolute shatter? And so we've over the last couple of years been building up this space called Firelock as a gathering place. It's got a giant geodesic dome that is established as kind of the primary gathering place on the land. We've got a craft workshop and a woodworking space and accommodation for facilitators. We are working on accommodations for guests. We're still about $1 million shy. If anybody has that hanging out in a couch cushion or something, let me know. Might be a while before we get that dream to take place. But in the interim, we host events here where people can come for rest and community gatherings. We did a stone soup event a couple of months ago. It was wonderful. We have a pizza oven on the property and some axe throwing in an outdoor pavilion, and so we play a lot. We have hammocks in a pine forest, like 15 of them, where people just snooze. Like there's lots of rest and reprieve centered work that we're doing here, focusing primarily on supporting people that are doing community development work. And this is set up as a social enterprise. So people who come like as a team and as an organization who can pay to be here, they do, and that keeps the lights on. And then we run programming, like we ran a 6-month-long Care for Caretakers fellowship that just enabled those breaks to talk about rest and shifting, making interventions in our lives so that we don't get to that point of acute burnout. And a lot of it, again, it's like, I don't know, I need a better word than selfish, but like I've learned so much by being the host of this kind of programming where people come here and they share their story and their why for being here. And you're like, yep, me too. What do you got? Like, what have you learned? Where are you at on that? And so little pieces of their story and my story and others that are here, like they all kind of just like make the picture of community health. It's been interesting. It's also not by any stretch done. It's not fully baked. It's still emerging. But yeah, it's at firelock.com if anybody wants to check it out and see what we're up to.
And send those $1 million. That's great.
E-transfer is fine. Yeah, however that works.
Once again, you are creating a little bit of a, a bigger physical scale, an open space, right, for people to do this inner work and to to return, to their lives, to their important work elsewhere. So it clearly is a, you can call it selfish if you want, but I think it's a like you that you're creating the space for these things to manifest in a way that's really, really beautiful.
But super important personally too, because this continues to be work that I want to do in the world, and I couldn't do it how I was doing it before the pandemic. Like I don't know that there's any going back to that. I think we have to figure out new patterns that are healthy, and tapping into like the I didn't even know what I was doing was already a thing. I didn't know about folk schools, first of all. We called it a folk school. I didn't even know that what was happened. Like I didn't know the history of any of that, which is embarrassing now looking back on it. And also like tapping into the knowledge of a global network of professionals who practice asset-based community development. Like if anybody's hearing that for the first time, do a quick Google search. But functionally, like how do we tap into the assets, no matter how small they are, how do we tap into the assets that exist in community and use those for the benefit of developing the kinds of communities that we want to live in? Like you can do that anywhere with like nickels, pennies, right? Like the history of this shows us that it doesn't take much. And I think about like, I don't know when people are going to be listening to this, but Jane Goodall just passed. And her final message to the world was so impactful for me. But basically, what she landed on was everybody is here for a reason. If you don't know what that reason is yet, keep trying anything because it's going to take all of us doing all kinds of little things with the gifts that we were given to build the kind of world we want to live in. And that is so, it rings out really true for me. I might not be like a protest organizer, but my own form of resistance is just the way that I choose to live my life. And I think all of us doing those little tiny things together puts those pinpricks of light, creates quite a glow.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I can't, I don't think there's a better way to end it than that. So Thank you for the work that you do, for the model you're bringing, all those pinpoints of light that you're sharing and creating a space for there, Jennifer. And thanks for being on the Micro College podcast.
Awesome. Thanks for the invite, Jacob. I look forward to hearing the rest of them too.